What's up, everybody? It's your man Lip here. This is Recover Together. We've got the Titan Phoebes, and we've got our guest over here, Mr. Lawrence, our certified recovery peer advocate. How are you doing today, Mr. Lawrence?
I'm doing good. Glad to be here. Glad to be sober. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. And how about you, Phoebes? It's been a while. I missed you, brother.
Yo, same, man. It's good to be back. Glad to be on. Good to hear your voice. Good to be on with Lawrence. Yeah, I'm feeling great. I'm looking forward to this show.
We got to give a shout out to Michael Orlando. We miss you so much, brother. We can't
I want to give mad credit to Michael Orlando. Even though he's not here, it's because in recovery, in our process in life, sometimes we got to draw boundaries that work for us in certain times in life. And I think he's just doing an awesome job looking out and taking
absolutely,
care of himself
absolutely.
Right now.
Absolutely.
So he's still in the spirit of Recover Together, even if he's not with us today.
He is here, though. He is here. And that's pretty awesome, because that's a great way to lead into the first poem that I'm going to read. I'm going to do a little bit of repeats, but first we're going to talk about real quick what we're going to be conversing about today. Relapse and relapse prevention. Those are two things that are huge when it comes to recovery. I mean, some people would argue that there is no recovery without relapse, but I mean, I don't know what the right answer to that would be. I'm among one of those people, but I mean, it took me quite a while to actually get committed to recovery. I don't know. Lawrence, have you worked in a bunch of different like rehabs, or what do you do?
I worked as a residential case manager for a men's halfway house for about 4 years, and then I worked in an agency where I did peer recovery work, the same as I'm doing now, just in a different format. I worked in and out of jails, in and out of hospitals. Court systems.
So what's your personal view on relapse? Is it an integral part of recovery, do you feel?
I feel it's part of recovery. It doesn't necessarily have to be a requirement, you know, but it does happen. The only thing I don't like about the word relapse is how it can be used to negatively describe
Absolutely.
People. You know, early on in my recovery, I would hear things like, he's a relapser, or he's a chronic relapser.
Yep.
I think a relapse is a personal tool that you can use to as a measuring stick of where you are. You know, like if you personally have a relapse, that doesn't negate all the other recovery experience that you've had. It's just an indication of like, you might need to make a change in your life.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, they say change people, places, and things, but then you get put in a situation like I'm in. I'm on parole, and my address wasn't approved, so I live up in a hotel. And do you know who else lives at hotels, Lawrence? Every drug addict in the county. So, I mean, it's kind of hard when you first get out of jail to actually be able to commit to relapse prevention, because you're literally jammed right in the middle of a situation where relapse kind of seems like the only thing that's even possible. When I first got out, I had this mindset. I was like, I'm not going to do anything. There's nothing that can change my mind. I've been in this hotel by myself now for 4 months. I mean, I'm so thankful to be free, but I'm not going to lie. It's the isolation, everything, it's a trigger. And I mean, sometimes the thought goes through my head, and I'm like, hey, maybe I would just feel better if I did a little bit. Maybe I should just stop taking my Suboxone so I could go shoot some dope. But I don't ever let it get that far. And if I were to let it get that far, I'd reach out for help immediately. That's what people need to realize. When they relapse, that doesn't mean that they failed. It means that you're getting another opportunity to ask for help. And that's the hardest part of recovery, is to ask for help. Once you do that, I mean, the rest is just baby steps the whole way. You got anything to say on the topic, Phoebes?
Really resonating with what you're both saying. One of the things I read when I was kind of prepping for the show today that really struck me is that there's kind of three stages to relapse. There's, you know, a lot of people just jump to what's considered, they consider the third stage, the physical relapse, right? But before that, there's usually an emotional relapse and then a mental relapse. So I think, you know, recognizing that when we think about what to do about relapse, we can't just hone in on, oh, that person, you know, took drugs again, and that's what we're focused on.
That's what everybody focuses on.
Right, but that's more of the symptom in some ways of the other
exactly
stages,
of the underlying cause. Yes.
So I think unless our programming and our supports get into that underlying deeper things, a relapse is not necessarily a failure of the person, but maybe a failure of
the teacher.
Of the recovery, the recovery process getting deep enough into what's going on.
Absolutely.
Well,
I'm going to start reading a couple poems. This is a big favorite of everybody's, so I'll start with this one. It's called Do I Inspire You? Do I inspire you? Because you inspire me. And what inspires me is to be inspiring. To be a light inside the dark, a light in which I bring. A song to lips of broken souls, a song for all to sing. Now and then, I come to think that my day soon will come. When I strive to reach my goals, I never walk, I run. I fight against all odds until my work is finally done. I've never met an obstacle I could not overcome. And to this day, I try to be the very best I can. I came to meet adversity with the well-made battle plans. And these confines I've constructed, I built with my own hands. As I did my destiny, alas, I'm just a man. Though I never fail, I falter and find I aim to be a man with goals accomplished, a man with dreams achieved. These drugs have been my downfall, but they also set me free, because now I can express myself through rhymes and poetry. Do I inspire you? Because you inspire me. And what inspires me is to be inspiring. You see, I wrote that to, like, open people's eyes to the fact that you never really know who you're motivating or inspiring to do anything. Like, I could be right now, hopefully, helping somebody decide that, okay, maybe it's time to stop. Maybe there's somebody out there listening right now that just heard that poem. And they're like, yeah, Lip, you do inspire me. And maybe they'll go for help now. That's what I hope for. But we also inspire people, like, negatively, too. Like, imagine two people walking down the road, and they're talking very loudly about an addict that they know, referring to them as a junkie, and there's people around, and we just happen to catch the ear of a person who was thinking about asking for help, but they see these two people they never met before just talking so freely about somebody who uses drugs and talking about them so badly that makes them not want to ask for help anymore. And that could be a bad situation. Maybe they could go and overdose, because who knows? Who knows what could happen? You never know who you inspire or what you inspire them to do. So, like, it just means to think before you act. And if you're going to act, like, do it with purpose, with reason. Don't ever do anything just to do it. Phoebes, I don't know, man. I don't know. Weren't you talking about, like, us planning some, like, outdoor events, some local stuff coming up soon?
I think that would be cool, you know, chance to build some community around Helping Hands Recovery, which is the larger
part
movement
of,
that birthed this podcast. But the podcast is not the whole project, right?
It's actually a very small part of it.
Exactly. So I think having, you know, the weather's warming up, where everyone still needs to be COVID conscious, so outdoor is a nice way to do that.
I think I have a great place in mind for it, too, Phoebes.
For anyone listening, make sure you're following Helping Hands recovery on social media and check in with this podcast and be looking out for some upcoming dates or some outdoor events where we can come together and see each other and further break down that feeling of isolation that can help.
And maybe we could even share our own creative writing. I'll definitely be reading some poetry. I would love it if people would show up with their own poetry. I would say probably by next week or the week after we'll have a date for you guys. And with that, I guess we'll take our first break.
Down, it's just talk. Smiles politely back at you. You stare politely right on through. Some sort of window to your right. She goes left and you stay right. Swing the lines, fear and blame. You begin to wonder why you came. Where did I go wrong?
Welcome back, everybody. It's Recover Together. Again, you're here with Lip, your host. We've got the Titan Phoebes, and we can't forget Lawless Lawrence, our certified recovery peer advocate. And he was saying during the break that he had something to say. So we're going to hear him out.
Yeah, I just wanted to circle back to what you were saying before about being released from the criminal justice system and then coming home and facing isolation and not having any kind of support. You know, a big part of my role is engaging people where they're at in the community.
Okay.
To try to help with that problem. The last position I just came off of, I would meet people that were incarcerated, and I would work on a safety plan when they got out and hopefully meet up with them and help them sort out all the different services, you know, because parole or probation says, oh, you got to go get an evaluation. You have to do all these things. You have to go to mental health. And then on top of it, you know, you have to go and get your insurance turned back on because you were incarcerated. You know, any kind of social services you may need, housing. So it's really a lot to digest. And people, when they come out, they're like, I got all these things to do. And it becomes very stressful, and it's very easy to say, you know what, I'm really stressed out about this, and I don't know how to get all this done on my own, not having transportation, not having anyone to rely on, so I might as well just use, you know.
That's really what it ends up being. That's exactly how people end up thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what's the point anyway? They just want me to go back to prison. And that is really what it feels like. That is how I feel on a daily basis, that I am just being set up by the entire world to go back to prison. Sometimes it feels like people who are supposed to be helping me want me to go back to prison. So why not get high? Because at least I'll feel good before I go back to the worst place I've ever been, you know?
Right, because they'll tell you, the legal system that is, they'll tell you, oh, well, when you really wanted drugs, you knew how to make that happen. So if you need to get a ride 50 miles from here to make this appointment, you'll figure it
ridiculous.
Out.
Ridiculous.
And my own experience with successfully completing 3 years of probation was that was just really unacceptable. You know, so part of why I've become a champion in this work is because I wanted to step in and make some changes and stop letting people fall through the cracks like that. So I think it's really important to be there for somebody and support them in the process and advocate for them for the systems that are sort of crushing down on them.
Well, I'm going to read another poem now. I'm going to read Immortalized. And then after that, I want to read the afterword, which is just it's the end of my book, my poetry book that I wrote, called The Key, and it's not for sale, so I didn't even need to tell you that it had a title, but alrighty guys, here's Immortalized. The world's a crazy place, you know, it's filled with so much spit, but sometimes I just can't control the need to nurture it, cause everything just lives to die while we all just die to live. That's why I cannot fathom why it matters if we sin. I've got a tale to tell of mine, a tale that which begins. A heart that's broken from the start, a bell that never rings. He fell apart not long ago and one day finally broke. His heart then slowly turned to stone, despairing as he choked. So is it so surprising that he finally turned to drugs? Tell me, what did you expect? They took the one he loved. As all his world began to fall and crumble to the ground, he tried to call and ask for help, but no one could be found. And all the words that he once spoke seemed not to make a sound. Lost, he couldn't find his way, any way but down. All the while he tumbled, he never lost his love for the world and those he cared, the ones he left above. He crept along the bowels of the earth and of his soul. Eternity had come to pass as he lost all control. He yearned so badly for the life that he had left behind. But can you really fix yourself while trapped inside your mind? Some things you just can't replace, like family and time. But now they're all immortalized here inside my mind.
Yeah, it makes me think of, like, the walls that we build to try to protect ourselves and end up pushing people out that really care about us.
Yeah, that's how what beginning is about. I mean, you go through an emotional trauma and you feel like you feel differently or you feel more strongly about it than the people around you. And in order to stop them from being mad at you for being more sad than them, you start putting up those walls like you were talking about. And then in order to cope with the sadness and then the guilt of you being more sad than the other people you're around and having to have had built those walls leads to drug use as a coping mechanism. That's what it all boils down to. We have poor coping mechanisms. It's just, I do now, but I didn't know how to deal with grief. When my mom died, I did not know what to do with my, I just became something that I had never in a million years think that I would have became. And it's like, it was just such a drastic change. Like, I went from this nice kid to a complete, like, criminal. Like, I was a scum bucket. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but I did. So, Phoebs, you got anything to say over there, buddy? You've been pretty quiet.
Yeah, just, you know, I love listening. I mean, vulnerability is, like, the word that popped in my head while you were talking. And, like, you know, you're talking about how even the roots, beginning of your addiction were tied up in the ability to be vulnerable, to ask for other coping mechanisms, support, grief support, you know, that, oh, I don't feel like I can ask for that, so I'm going to turn to, you know, drugs to help me.
Exactly.
With what's going on. And you know, 75% of people with addiction, you know, and it's probably even higher, but have some serious trauma in their background, you know, and that underlies the addiction. And when I think about our topic in relapse, I feel like the vulnerability, like there's a way in which, you know, asking for help, right, is a very vulnerable step.
Absolutely.
And I think when someone takes that step and then struggle, because, like, struggle's part of the process, and maybe that includes relapsing, if the person that you reached out to who seemed to offer support then start to be like, well, nope, I can't keep supporting you, you're relapsing, you're falling back into old habits, it sends a message that vulnerability is not safe.
That
it sends
bad.
A message that
yeah.
asking for help is not safe. And I think I would say to anybody listening who's a friend or support to somebody in recovery, that if you're going to step into that role of letting someone open up and be vulnerable and ask for help, don't do that if you're not willing to kind of stick it out, you know, for the long, not to say you can't have your own boundaries and healthy limitations, but to shut it down because a person has ongoing struggle, I think can actually set a person up for worse failure than if you just didn't open up that door.
Absolutely. Because they ask for help and then you turn your back on them because they relapsed and now they have no reason not to go even deeper into what they were doing. It's just people don't understand, like, the emotions that go along with addiction. I mean, I'm sure there are some sociopathic addicts who don't feel anything, but for the most part, addiction is a very emotional disease. Like, when I feel sad, I really feel sad. When I feel good from putting a drug in my body, I really feel good. It's all about how you feel. And it's just, I don't know, it's really hard to cope with. It's really tough. And the people who are coming forward to ask for help should be respected. And they shouldn't be made to feel like they're getting in trouble. They should be made to feel like they're appreciated, they're respected, they're held to a higher standard than the peers of their demographic, I guess.
Yeah, so you guys make good points. You know, a lot of people that suffer with addiction usually have a trauma component, and you know, drug use is just a symptom of that. And you know, the use is a self-medication. When we were in a group with the kids yesterday, one of the girls had said, you know, when a person takes their medication, and then she turned around and said, you know, something to do with their addiction. And I was like, no, wait, that's perfect what you said, because that's what it is for us. For a normal person, when they have a headache, they take aspirin. For us, you know, when we have feelings of doubt and insecurity and flashbacks from the trauma, the drugs become a medication. You know?
Absolutely. They 100% do.
And as far as the coping skills, you know, some of it is like we didn't have good teachers, or our teachers had their own traumas and their own issues, and they didn't know how to teach us. So, you know, those coping skills, you know, you're not going to get it in school. If your parents aren't strong people, or have learned how to master their own minds, like, they may not be able to offer anything. But instead of people saying, hey, I'm not well equipped to really help you process your situation, they just shut you out.
Yeah, no, that happens all too often. It's happened to me. It's happened to me with some very important people. But I luckily am very charismatic, and I'm good with my words, so I usually win them back. But it hurts when people just walk away from you when you're at the most vulnerable state you could be in, and you come up to them and you're like, I'm sorry, and they tell you, no, you're not. Yeah, I am. I don't know what else to tell you. Like, it's not like, I don't think most of us want to disappoint our families. We just want to feel better, and like, even feeling nothing, because when I was shooting dope, that's what I felt. That was what I was getting. That was my escape. Numbness. Nothingness. I didn't have to feel the intense sadness that I woke up to every morning, as long as I did a little bit of dope. And I just continued doing that until I went to jail. And then I had a wake-up call, but it didn't happen until like 2 years into jail. So it was just, there's just a lot more to do with it than people think. There needs to be more studies done on the psychology of addiction, and what HHR is like eventually going to become is like a new sort of support group. It's going to take the things that like AA and NA have that are working, and we're going to add our new ideas, our generation's ideas, because it's time for something to change. There's not one road to recovery. There's a million roads to recovery, a billion roads to recovery, because every addict is different. So recovery is as individualized as the addict is themselves. I mean, sure, some people might be able to do it in similar ways, but it's not like everybody can just do the same thing. Oh, I'm going to go to group 5 days a week, and then I'm never going to get high again. It just doesn't work like that. But the bureaucracy wants you to believe that it does, so you would just keep coming back and keep coming, because they don't want it to work. That's what HHR is going to change. That's what this movement's going to be, and I need as many people behind me as possible.
What is HHR?
HHR is Helping Hands Recovery. It's an organization that I made. We have a pretty, not a huge, but a nice following on Facebook, probably about 700 people.
Yeah.
Recently, I stopped using Facebook, and I appointed Heather Allen as my liaison. So she's kind of running the whole Facebook page right now. And she's wonderful. She's like one of our best like peer counselors. She'll sit there and answer messages all day long and just try to help people. And that's really all we're trying to do. It doesn't matter if you're an addict, or it's just when you're at a low point in your life, we're there to help you. And it's gonna change the world one day. It really is. I believe strongly in it. I lost faith a little bit a couple of weeks back, cause just it seemed like everything was falling apart, and that's why we weren't here last week, because I wasn't thinking that it was worth doing anymore. But I woke up and I realized that there's nothing in the world that there is more worth doing than this, because we're going to help people. We're going to save people. We might already have saved people. So,
yeah, that's the thing. Like, you know, sometimes when you lose faith, you have to remember you've had the experience of having both, you know, using and staying clean. So it's hard to go back to that lifestyle once you know that there's a better way. And, you know, I agree with what you were saying before. You know, recovery is subjective, and there are multiple pathways to recovery. That's what we've been advocating for years. And whatever works for you, whatever we can do for you to help your situation, should be the way.
Absolutely. All right, guys, I'm going to read the afterword, and then after after I get done with that, we're going to listen to Relapse, or no, a song off of Eminem's Relapse album called Same Song and Dance. This is the afterword. I love writing poetry. I always have for as long as I can remember. I feel like it's the easiest and most effective way to communicate. This is my first real collection of original poetry. I've written and accumulated all of these poems during my 4-year sentence of incarceration. None were written before and none were added after my release. I feel this is important to stress as this compendium carefully attempts to illustrate and define my various thoughts, feelings, and emotions throughout my sentence. I firmly believe this is a very powerful expression of my evolving prison experience and thought process during my bid. It was important to me to convey the sense of growth that I felt take place within myself during my journey. The at times overwhelming experience of emotions I felt. I hope that having read this collection, you may have come to know me a little bit better, you know, and perhaps even relate to me in your own ways. For through having written these poems is how I finally came to know myself and relate to myself. Mental health is a largely reoccurring theme throughout my work. It's my goal that everyone who reads these poems, that they understand that they're not alone and that it's okay to talk about things. It's not okay. It's okay not to be okay. And for people to learn that writing poetry is a profoundly powerful way to express equally powerful emotions. If reading this collection helps even one person, then my goal has been accomplished. I'm living proof that anybody can create beautiful artwork, that you can take any situation and use it not only to reveal yourself to you, but to help other people along their paths as well. Remember, you're beautiful. You're the light. You're the key. Thank you. And with that, I'm going to let Eminem take over, and then when we come back, the Titan Phoebes is going to paint the bigger picture.
Yeah. Same song and dance. Damn, girl. Everywhere I go, same song and dance. I like the way you move all over the globe. Same song and dance. Something about it, man. Same song and dance. In the pale moonlight. Yeah. I'm looking at you, yeah, girl. You're kind of taken back by the whole rapper thing, aren't you? Probably thinking you get so dang hard, you won't even be able to stand up straight, aren't you? Couple charges, people think you're a monster. The police constantly bugging you nonstop. I walk up on you, well, hello, Tanya. I think you got your OnStar button inside your car stuff. You out to gas, do you got the flat? I would hate for you to be stranded at the laundromat. I got your back, why don't you put your laundry basket in the back and sit up front? I'm not asking, it's a trap. You just got jacked and it's a rap in broad day and no mask for this attack. I heard him say exact opposite the track. If that's a fact, it'll take task force to get you back. Yeah, baby, do that dance. It's the last dance you'll ever get the chance to do. Girl, shake that. You ain't never gonna break that glass. That windshield's too strong for you. I said, yeah, baby, sing that song. It's the last song you'll ever get the chance to sing. You sexy little thing, show me what you got. Give it your all, look at your ball. Why you crying to me? Same song. The first victim I had, she was a big one. Big movie star, a party girl, big fun. She was the girl the media always picked on. In and out to rehab every 4 to 6 months. She was always known for little pranks and slick stunts. And Nickelodeon flashed the little kids once. What an event it was, I was sitting in front. I was hooked in at the first glimpse of them buns. Seen her backstage, now here's why I come in, son. Look, here she comes, I better pull out the big guns. Hello, Lindsay, you're looking a little thin, hun. How about to ride to rehab? Get in. But starting off on the wrong foot is what I didn't want. Girl, I'm just kidding, let me start over again, hun. See, what I meant was, we should have a little intervention. Come with me to Brighton, let me relieve your tension, you little wincher. That wasn't my intention. If I wanted to kick you, it would have already been done. Slowly she gets in and I begin to with 66 inches of extension. Yeah, baby, do that dance. It's the last dance you'll ever get the chance to do. Girl, shake that. You ain't never gonna break that glass. That windshield's too strong for you. I said, yeah, baby, sing that song. It's the last song you'll ever get the chance to sing. You sexy little thing, show me what you got. Give it.
at your all, look at your ball, why you crying to me? My second victim was even bigger than the first. Pop star, icon, the whole works. She played a little schoolgirl when she first burst upon the scene. It seemed that the world was hers. She twirls and turns and flirts and skirts so bad it hurts. It irked me and made me mad at first. I lashed out to my songs, but what was really going on was that I had developed a crush. I just didn't know how to tell it to her. Should I keep one of my ears and mail it to her? Send her pictures of my collection of skeletons or footage of me impaling myself on an elephant tusk? We'll settle this once and for all, I'ma tell her at dusk. Tonight, tonight is the night, and tell her I must creep up to a mansion and stilettos and just climb the gate and ring the bell like hello my love. I just picked your prescription for Seroquel up. Now would you like to share a pill or two with me? I'll share my value with you cause I'm feeling you, Brittany. I trade you a blue one for a pink one. Ever since a schoolgirl drew but not a link one. I've been feeling you, ooh, ooh, girl. You sexy little gal. You hold that pill any longer, it'll get sentimental value. Come on, touch, give me the Valium, alley-oop. I'll slam dunk it in your mouth till you puke. And just as soon as you pass out in your alphabet soup, I'm about to make a new outfit out to you. A new outfit, I'll make a suit out to your shoot. Now show me how you move, baby, do how you do. Yeah, baby, do that dance. It's the last dance you'll ever get the chance to do. Girl, shake that. You ain't never gonna break that glass. That windshield's too strong for you. I said, yeah, baby, sing that song. It's the last song you'll ever get the chance to sing. You sexy little thing, show me what you got. Give it your all, look at your ball. Why you crying to me? Same song and dance. Same kicking and screaming, same crying and sobbing. Same song and dance. Same begging and pleading, same yelling and same song and dance. Yeah. Same song and dance. I know. Same song and dance.
That was the same song and dance. And we are back. And it is time for Phoebs the Titan to paint the bigger picture.
Hey, hey, hey. Ooh, yeah. So, and y'all don't hesitate to jump in if anything sparks your thinking about it, but.
Oh, I won't. You know that.
So, one of the things that I think is interesting is that the National Institute for Drug Abuse actually defines addiction at its core as a chronic relapsing disease. And so relapse is built into what the disease is about. So I hope that kind of helps maybe break down the stigma a little bit, that relapse is somehow a failure versus just something that is something to be anticipated. And I definitely disagree with the sort of propaganda idea of like relapse is part of the process. Because to Lawrence's point, that's not true for everybody. But
It would
be naive to think that a chronic relapsing disease does not include relapse as part of what we're dealing
chronic
with.
Chronic means that it goes away and comes back. That's the definition
exactly.
of chronic.
And you like, live with it for your whole life.
Entire life.
Something that must always be tended. The statistics show that about 40 to 60% of folks who have been through some sort of drug treatment end up having a relapse experience. Now, those statistics drop as time goes out. So if you're looking at statistics for people who are 5 years out from their treatment and recovery, those numbers are probably going to be lower than folks who are 6 months out, right? There is a sort of reduction over time, which makes sense, right? Because those folks have been building stability, building those coping skills, learning how to find that deeper intrinsic motivation to keep going. And that takes a while.
It sure does.
But you know what was interesting, too, in terms of stigma? That same study was saying that the rates of relapse for addiction are almost exactly the same as the rates of relapse for other chronic diseases, such as asthma, hypertension, and type 2 diabetes.
Proving that it is a disease. Like,
right.
Wow.
And you know, again, you know, Lawrence brought this up, too. Physical health issues tend not to have the same stigma as addiction, even though they are all diseases of the body. And, you know, to be fair, there are plenty of folks, you know, in different communities who also get stigmatized for relapsing in diabetes, right? Because they'll be like, well, why didn't you stay on, you know? It all gets put on the person for their treatment and their process not working well, instead of just honoring the fact that their body, you know, will have these sort of relapse cycles potentially. But yeah, chronic diseases do have the potential of relapse all the time. And it's really about, you know, a lot of the stories about relapse that I hear are also people start to feel like they're getting to that stable ground and want to and stop leaning into those support systems, right? Just like somebody with type 2 diabetes might stop going to their preventative care doctor every month because they feel like they've got it under control, right? And then that makes you vulnerable again. So I think a piece of this for folks listening is about, you know, you recovery being a lifelong process where the nature of your support systems might change over time, but it helps to continuously acknowledge within yourself that your body is vulnerable to this chronic disease rearing its head again, and that you should continuously tend it, especially when you're feeling really good. Because when you're feeling good and things are going better, you know, now suddenly maybe you find yourself at a party again that you avoided for the first 2 years, and some of the old triggers are going to come back up. So it just feels really important to recognize in the bigger picture that this is a physical disease, that it shows the exact same rates of relapse as other physical chronic diseases. There's nothing special about people with addiction that makes them more relapse, you know, prone than anybody else with a physical disease, that they're learning how to change their habits, their mentality, and their practices around.
Can I say something on the subject?
Please.
So a lot of times when I'm in the community trying to reduce stigma around addiction, I use examples like that. And I have a lot of examples from my own personal life, family and friends. You know, I've asked somebody that had a mild cancer one time, like what it meant, what the difference between recovery and recovered is. And, you know, they said, well, when I was in treatment for my cancer and I was getting chemotherapy and different treatments, you know, I was in recovery. And once you've come to the point of like 5 years or 10-year milestones, you know, you're considered in remission from that cancer. And that's very much how, you know, people in recovery look at addiction too. And they said, it doesn't mean that my cancer is not going to come back. It's just at this moment, I've come to a point where it looks safe enough that it won't return. And the same thing, I know a lot of people that are diabetic, and I've been in the hospital when people have had some of their appendages cut off. And one of the first things when they come out of surgery, they want some sort of sugary snack. And nobody in the family, none of the person's friends are like, no, you can't have that.
No, they go to the vending machine and get them a Snickers.
Right. they're not like, no, you can't have that because this is what got you here.
But when the addict comes out of the hospital after just having an abscess cut off of his arm and he wants to go get a hit, nobody wants to talk to him anymore.
Right.
Nobody wants him around anymore.
But I feel like with the general public, if you use examples like that that people can relate to, it may have an impact and they may start to look at things differently.
No, because they'll just be like, oh, well, they didn't choose to be diabetic. Because that's what the mainstream society believes, that we chose to become addicts. No, I chose to use the drug. I didn't choose to have to need it to survive. They don't understand the difference.
It was a choice the first time, but every time after that, it's no choice.
And it's not any different than, like, anybody. Like, there's a million people right now trying drugs for the first time, and half of them are going to be completely fine and not ever do it again. The other half are going to end up like I did, and that's why we have this show. Anyway.
And that speaks to also what's invisibilized, which is all the things that led to that point of vulnerability, of using a drug becoming a pathway of addiction versus just an experience in your life, right? Because just like somebody with diabetes, right, somebody with an addiction, the first time that diabetic person ate too much sugar and set their system into overload, or the first time that person with drug addiction took that drug and sparked, you know, that sort of neurological addictive response, there was literally their whole life of experience before that and their genetic history that all feed into the likelihood that that's going to be a chronic disease for them. So even the choice to use the first time is not what defines whether or not you are going to be, you know, have an addiction. right? It's all these other pieces that are not your choice. You didn't choose if there's a history of addiction in your family. You didn't choose if there's a history of trauma in your early life. You didn't choose, you know, that your brain has a particularly strong sort of like neurological attachment to that substance.
You know, I'm really glad that you're pointing all this out, because most people will call those excuses, but you, my friend, are telling us, and everybody else that's listening, that there are reasons, not excuses. There's a difference.
Exactly.
Yeah, and relapsing is no difference than, like, cheating on a diet. You know?
Yes, that was the example I wanted to bring in, actually, with this, too, about, you know, about also the pathway then of figuring out what you do next in your life, right? Because I think about a diet, such a useful, I think food is often a really useful example for folks who are not struggling with drug addiction, because it's similar, right? A food is a drug. It goes into your body and it has a chemical impact on you. But when people are saying, I want to start a diet, it's very rare that the first set of dietary restrictions you set on yourself are the final path forever in your life. Typically what happens is you start a diet, you cut things out, you try some new things, and then maybe you see some improvement in some areas in your physical health, but you're lacking in other places, and you start to figure that out. You find the balance of what you need in your life. You know, is it just food, actually? Is it some exercise I got to work in, right? There's all these different things, and nobody judges a person for having the agency and the choice to go through iterations of their own sort of relationship to their body and what they need in their body to feel well. But again, somebody with substance abuse is never really afforded that same sort of autonomy and agency and respect to go through that process for themselves and to find through trial and error and through process what can sustain them for the long run. And I think it's really important we do that. I do believe that the harm reduction movement has brought this work closer to that point, kind of shifting away from a straight sobriety and do your 10 steps and this is the way, to, okay, what are the harms that this behavior is creating in your own life that you want to change, and what do we do to get at those harms specifically? So it's less of a focus on the symptom and more of a focus on the actual impact in your life. And that approach opens up the door for folks to not have to, you know, again, the diet example, to not be like, you will never eat sugar again, period. Like, and if you eat sugar again, I will stop speaking to you and you can't sleep over here anymore. Like, right?
Yes, it's very person-centered. It's exactly, sitting down with the person exactly. And figuring out what they need, not me determining what the person needs.
Precisely. And because that was the other thing in the, you know, reading some folks' different, you know, perspectives on relapse and stuff. A lot of folks will speak to the relapse was, I was more vulnerable to the relapse because my deep intrinsic motivation to stop wasn't fully developed yet. There was still a really loud part of me that wanted that. And I think to find what motivates a person to stay on a path of recovery, to stay on a path of reducing harm in their life, has to find their unique motivation and unique reasoning to keep them on track for that. It can't be your sister's motivation. It can't be your partner's motivation.
Exactly.
It can't, you know, your therapist's motivation. It has to be your motivation. And, you know, like when you said there's a billion ways to recovery, there's 6 billion people on this earth.
Exactly.
There's 6 billion pathways to recovery.
That is why you are the Titan, Phoebes.
That's why January 1st, everybody posts New Year, New Me. And gym
January
membership
2nd.
Goes up. Uh-huh. And, you know, as the weeks go on, people drop out. But recovery is like that, too. There's a lot of false starts. There's a lot of missed trips to the gym, you know.
All right, we got 10 minutes left. I'm just going to I wanted to interject on the last thing you said, Phoebes. You said your partner. You can't do it for your partner. I feel like that's more of a trigger for relapse than a trigger for, like, success. When you're trying to do something for your partner, especially if your partner was somebody you used with. That's why I wrote this poem called Junkie Love. And after this poem, we're going to take one more quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll tell y'all good night. All right. Junkie Love. Love is crazy, especially when both parties are heroin addicts. Don't get me wrong. The love is real and arguably more intense. Each day you struggle together. You have each other's backs whenever. The bond you build forever. Your junkie lover is truly your treasure. There's a certain type of trust involved in allowing someone to prepare potentially problematic poisons for you to inject straight to your heart. But you know each other so well that you're completely confident you've mixed just the right amount to keep your junkie lover's heart barely beating, and their lungs barely breathing, and their eyes barely seeing, but their high fully completed. And when you catch your nod, you collapse into each other's arms, barely conscious enough for the kiss you both so desperately crave. You know that you're in love, that you found your soulmate. Through constricted pupils, we see clearly. We may be heroin addicts, but we're in love. And for us, our love is enough. This life, we know, can be tough. Together, our hearts beat as one. Forever, whatever may come. And like that leads us into this song right here. What is up, guys? We are back. And that was Breaking the Habit. You see what I did there with the junkie love and Breaking the Habit? See, I'm a pretty witty guy.
Yeah, it was tight.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to Snapchat the end of the show, Phoebes. I'm getting all kinds of crazy feedback from doing this, just so everybody knows. But I'm just deciding to put a little bit more publicity out there. So you guys could see that I actually do something other than sit around my hotel all day. I hang out and I sit around this clubhouse all day. And I talk to you guys and hopefully some of you guys listen. because we really we really do have a lot to say. It's cool. It's cool. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to let folks know that the Catskill Clubhouse is a resource for other folks who might need a supportive space. That, you know, we work both with folks under 18 and young adults. So up to age 35, I think we're pretty flexible. If you need help, talk to us. You know, and the whole point of this space is to create an environment that breaks the stigma, that is person-centered. You don't, you know, whatever stage you're in with your, in your life, whether you're somebody who's struggling with addiction yourself or you're somebody supporting a family member or a friend, there's a lot of different resources that we can connect you to. So I want folks to know we're in Main Street in Catskill, and you can find us, you can find us online, Catskill Clubhouse, and we're here for you.
I got most of that on Snap. I held the headphones up to my phone fumes. I tried to get you out there. But yeah, everybody, we really are here. Because whenever you guys feel alone, you really need to realize that you're not. We're all in this together. And if you're thinking about, like, getting up or getting high or anything, you can call my cell phone. I'm going to have it put on HHR's website today. It's going to be posted so anybody who wants it can have it. I don't care if it's 3 in the morning. If you're stuck at a party and you're at a place you don't want to be at, you're uncomfortable, you can call me, and I will do whatever I can to get you out of that situation. I'll help you however I can. If you say to me, Lip, or, well, what most of you would probably call me, Phil, I'm ready to start thinking about recovery. I'll accept that, and that doesn't mean you have to stop using right then. I can work with that. I can work with, I'm ready to start thinking about recovery, because now I know I can put some ideas in your head. I can plant some seeds, and hopefully with a little bit of tender love and care, they'll grow.
I feel recovery starts when you put it out into the universe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Once you tell somebody or you tell yourself out loud, I can't live like this anymore, I need help.
Yeah, and then when people do that, I mean, they still do continue to get high for a while, and then people tend to say, oh, you're not even trying. If you really didn't want to get high, you just wouldn't. But it's not that simple. Like Phoebs was pointing out, there's all these crazy brain chemicals going on. Like, there's, like, actual, like, biological things happening inside of us that are causing us to desire these drugs and stuff. Like, I don't know. But hopefully, after today's show, y'all got a little bit of a better understanding of what relapse is and what addiction is and how some ways for relapse prevention, like call a friend or move a muscle, change a thought. That's a rehab saying. There's a bunch of stuff. I mean, write a poem, listen to some music, jump rope. I don't care what you do, just don't get high. And if you're going to, do it safely. Phoebs?
Absolutely. That's key. Harm reduction. We want you to be okay. We want you to survive. Something I learned just today, actually, is a acronym called DOSE.
Yes.
Which is the four chemicals in your brain that are what is working against some of what you're telling yourself you want for yourself. But each of those four chemicals can be fed many, many different ways. So, dopamine, that's pleasure, that's reward. Find ways to make easy things for yourself to reward, you know, to feel like a sense of accomplishment and that
epinephrine.
Reward. Oxytocin, right? That's touch, that's connection. Hug somebody. Serotonin, that comes from gratitude and from altruism. Like, you know, working with somebody, helping somebody out, being willing to receive some care, and endorphins, right? Exercise, like Lip was just saying, right? So just if you can keep reminding yourself, you know, that what those four things happening in your body that are cannot be overcome by just willpower, but are actually tended through finding different ways to meet those needs, that can keep you on track. And it's a long journey, but there's
so
a lot of people who want to see you succeed.
It's a long journey. He's right. So why would you do it alone? remember, guys, we love you even if you don't love yourself, and we believe in you even if you don't believe in yourself. And when you recover together, you just might recover forever. Have a good night, guys.
Is the detriment, and let that sink in. You can think again when the hand you wanna hold is a weapon and nothing but skin. Oh, cause I keep digging myself down deeper. I won't stop till I get where you are. I keep running, I keep running.
Alrighty, guys, like I said, you're never alone, and I'll believe in you forever. If we recover together, we just may recover forever. We'll catch you all next week, same time, same place. Have a good night.